I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Now that holiday shopping can be done with a click of a button, why do people still line up as early as Thanksgiving afternoon to get a start on big box store sales? In this Black Friday edition of Midday, we'll take a look at consumer psychology and hear what's on many shopping lists this holiday season. Then, following the death of his father, a young man in East Baltimore worked with local artists to paint a mural. He tells us how art has helped him heal. And with the start of winter less than a month away, what do urban farmers in Baltimore have in store? We'll speak with two of them. That's Midday, after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm so glad you've joined us, and I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving. Later in today's show, a mural in East Baltimore memorializes a young man's father. We speak to this young man about the project, what the project has meant to him, as well as the artists who led the mural's creation. And we find out what's in store this winter for a couple of urban farmers. But first, it's noon, the day after Thanksgiving. That means we're already deep into holiday shopping season. Traditionally, Black Friday, the day retailers count on replacing red ink in their accounts with black ink, is today, the day after Thanksgiving. But 4 years ago, big box stores, including Kohl's, Macy's, and Best Buy, opened their doors at midnight, the last minute of Thanksgiving. And since then, doors have opened even earlier. This year, Sears, Target, JCPenney, Dick's Sporting, and Old Navy, to name just a few, opened as early as 2 p.m. yesterday. And that's not the whole picture. Not only has Black Friday extended backward, encompassing the holiday it used to follow, but also forward into the weekend with Small Business Saturday and into next week with Cyber Monday. Joining me to make sense of these pandemonic shopping days and give us a forecast of what products we'll see fly from the shelves is Philippe Duverger, professor of marketing at Towson University. His articles about marketing have been published in International Journal of Market Research and the Journal for Advancement in Education. Welcome to Midday.
Welcome.
Also joining us on the phone from New York is Barry Myers. He's founder and president of Get Geeked Media, a company that aims to help consumer tech brands address difficult marketing challenges. Barry Myers, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Philippe, let's start with you. Has the advent of these additional shopping days, such as Cyber Monday and Small Business Saturday, have they made the turnout for Black Friday smaller?
Yes, in a sense, yes. People are shopping online, and as we've seen in the past, I guess, 10 years, let's say, all the folks like me tend to shop, you know, in brick and mortar, what we call brick and mortar retailer stores, and then younger folks tend to shop online. This is not true anymore today. Today, this has merged together, and the older folks are a little bit more techy, and the younger folks maybe are looking for an experience by, you know, lining up on the sidewalk and make it some kind of a ritual with their friends. So it's sort of merged together, and I think the retailers are looking at the whole event as a both a physical brick and mortar and an online event altogether.
Well, Barry Myers, you're involved in the tech and cyber world. Do you see cyber shopping taking the front seat?
I think that's correct. I think it's being driven by a couple of things. What Philippe just said, of course, I agree with, but you're also seeing the younger folks who used to be, you know, not exclusively, but primarily the online shoppers now moving to mobile devices, and the increased power and capabilities and functionalities of these mobile devices is really driving a lot of the online shopping as well.
Driving the online shopping because people can shop anywhere, or driving it because people in a store use their mobile devices to check out the prices they might get elsewhere?
Both, actually, but primarily because they can now shop anywhere. I mean, these devices are obviously, you know, as powerful as PCs were just a few years ago, and they can shop on their smartphone, on their tablet, on whatever device they might have in their hand at the moment.
So the big mourning that some of us did a few years ago when the stores started to open on Thanksgiving and then on into the afternoon, hey, no problem. You just sit with your family, you finish your Thanksgiving dinner, and you tap away on your phone and buy things that way, Philippe?
Yes and no, because maybe what you want is not available on the phone. You know, it's sort of a chicken and the egg. I was going to say the turkey and the egg, but I don't know. But it's sort of a chicken and the egg thing. Is you know, if you're the retailer and your business is online, let's say Amazon, you want the people to shop from their bed or from in front of the TV or something. But if you're Walmart, you probably want to bring them to the store, because once you're in the store, all the way in to get that flat screen TV, as you're coming out, you're going to shop for more. This is the idea of the lost leader or the bait and switch, if it's you know, to the extreme, to the negative, where you have very limited supply of that big ticket item, but you have to go all the way in the store, and then when you come out, that's when really Walmart makes his profit.
That's Philippe Duverger, professor of marketing at Towson University, here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Kasten. Also with us is Barry Myers from New York City, the president of Get Geeked Media, which advises consumer tech brands on marketing challenges. Is there a clear divide, Barry, between what people are willing to buy online and what people still want to go into a store to buy hands-on?
I think there isn't nearly the divide there was just a few years ago when consumer electronics, in particular television sets and audio devices, consumers still felt they needed to touch, see, feel, hear. But now I don't believe that's the case as much. And, you know, some of that is actually driven by better return policies, better customer service, and easier ability to return some of these devices. So I think the divide is slowly going away. I certainly think there are still, you know, lots of people who will be very hesitant to invest in a flat panel TV or a very high-end pair of headphones even without getting a chance to hear and see them.
Philippe, how do you see it?
Yeah, I see it more from a psychological point of view. You want to show your crowd, your culture, your family that you're good for going and hunt for that TV, and then you're victorious with that TV, and you're going to show your neighbor next, which is the next day, Saturday morning, tomorrow, if you drive by your neighborhood, you will see those big boxes on the side of the road, showing the world that you've been victorious, and that's kind of a ritual. And, you know, it comes from way back when.
You're pulling my leg.
No, not at all.
Really?
No.
You yes. Really think that's a big part of consumer psychology?
Of
is showing
course.
All? Showing? I mean, I look at boxes at the side of the road, and I just think of, gee, I hope that gets recycled and not trashed. It really is something that people take pride in?
Of course, yes. And then when you invite people for, let's say, Super Bowl or even the next football game, you're going to talk about your experience. So you're going to say, you know, this is what we did in order to get that TV. We paid it this much and so on. So you're going to brag about it. You have bragging rights to your friends, and now they are jealous and now they want the same thing, but it's too late because, you know, and so on and so forth. So the retailer knows that and plays on that. That's the idea.
Boy, there's a whole subtext that I've been missing entirely. Since we're into consumer psychology, let me ask you this. As far as discounts, how low do stores have to drop a price to get people interested?
It's a song, no? How low do you have to go? well, okay, there's a theory here that says it needs to be meaningful for people to be important, and usually it's 20%. But as I was talking to my daughter on the way here coming in, she said, no, 20% is not a Black Friday discount. I'm expecting 75%. So I would say 50% is the minimum that you need to show to get some meaning for people to go and fight the crowd. If you don't
How
have
much?
50, 50, 50,
really?
50%, yes.
Does that make sense to you, Barry?
I'd agree with that. I mean, it brings to mind one of the kind of more alarming trends I think we're starting to see in the last couple of years, and that's where the manufacturers with the retailers in hand are getting very savvy to the importance of what used to be Black Friday and Cyber Monday, but is now referred to in the industry as Black Friday week. And they're actually producing hardware and devices specifically for this week. And you have to be pretty savvy to not get drawn in by some of those products that are being produced specifically for Black Friday week, because, you know, a typical consumer with a flat panel TV is going to look at size and brand, and if they see Sony 55 inch and it's 50% off, you know, they're, as Philippe said, they're ready to grab their spear and go on the hunt. But very often now, these are products that are being manufactured specifically for the week, and the component parts might not be as good. They might not have as many accessories available or as many ports and important things that often go unnoticed in the hunt during this week.
Yes, and also the percentage off is often on the original price, quote unquote, original price being not the price that you had the day before Thanksgiving or the day after Black Friday, but the original price, you know, call it the manufacturing price, and therefore the 50% is not really 50%. It might actually be only a 25% when you see that item back on the shelf, if it ever makes it back on the shelf. As Barry was saying, most of the things that you have on sale are just produced for that week or just end of series or not necessarily what you think you wanted to get.
So, Philippe, what items do you foresee flying off the shelves this season?
Yeah, well, a flat screen TV is always, you know, a good one. Electronics in general. I think this year you're going to see a lot of drones. I mean, just to make a pun on flying off the shelf, a lot of drones will fly off the shelves because that's sort of the big thing. And that's basically it. Electronics. Of course, you're going to have everything else on sale, but really, what people are going to fight for is what Barry was saying: is the things that you're still reluctant to buy online because it's big, it's not going to arrive, you know, within a couple of days, and you're not sure. You still want to, you know, touch and feel and so on. So those big items, those electronic items, will be the winner of the weekend. But the weekend is going to be a lot softer than last year and the year before and so on.
I want to ask you about that in a minute, yeah. But let me ask Barry. So Philippe says it's electronics. You're the electronics guy. What particular items do you think are going to be big this season?
I can break that down even more. Certainly TVs and tablets and laptops, tablets in particular more than laptops. And some of that is driven by the need to get rid of previous models now that you're seeing, for instance, the Apple iPad Pro and the Microsoft Surface 4, which are both getting great reviews. And now companies with new releases need to, of course, get rid of that older inventory. Gaming consoles, we think, will be really big this year. You're seeing $50 off the top on all types of different game plus console bundles for the Xbox One and the PS4, and there's a couple of pretty exciting new games out there, and that sometimes is a real big driver of the console sales as well. Headphones, Bluetooth speakers are terrific presents because they're not exorbitantly expensive, and you'll see a ton of those. And, you know, as Philippe said, drones, I mean, I would put drones in this kind of bigger category of, you know, these emerging technology categories. I mean, it's a real amazing time for hardware, consumer hardware right now. And we're all eager to see how drones do this year, how different electronic toys and robotics types toys do, how smartwatches and other wearable devices do, how a lot of the connected home devices do. I mean, you know, we're all expecting the sales of these different categories to increase because they're new and they're exciting, but we're just not sure how fast and how quickly they'll increase.
Okay, so Barry, you're looking for some kind of increase, but Philippe, you said a few minutes ago you think the whole weekend is going to be disappointment.
We expect the brick and mortar sale to be lower than the years before. It has been on the decline, so it will continue to decline. Taken all together with the online, it's probably going to even off. But the problem is the people brick and mortar are not exactly the same as the people online. So we're still shifting to an online type of purchase. So, you know, if you take it by items and if you look at a big screen TV, just that item probably will sell well in the store and maybe less well online. But if you're looking at small electronics, you could argue that even a tablet and so on is small electronics, people would probably buy it more online than they would buying at the store. Why would you want to line up, in the middle of the night to get a tablet, right? If it's not the latest tablet, then you don't want to do that. You're not talking to the Apple aficionado, the early adopter of Apple product. You're talking to the late adopter here. These are people that wish they had the tablet and will line up on the sidewalk to get an older tablet or a tablet with less feature. So it's we're not talking about the same population.
Well, I saw a report from an analysis firm called Columbia Threadneedle Investments that said, quote, consumers are increasingly spending on experience over things, while spending on durables like cars and homes continues to take share from non-durables like clothing and accessories. Do you agree with that? Are people looking, are some of the money that you might have expected people to put into durables or nifty electronics, are they putting it into cruises instead or movies?
Well, yeah, I think it's maybe you have to take that in the context of coming out of a recession. So during the recession, you don't change your car, you don't fix your home, you're saving, you're in survival. Recession ends, you still have your job and so on, or you get a job back and so on. What do? The first thing is you buy a new car, you fix your home, and then maybe you're going to go for that flat screen TV. And then maybe after that, now you're thinking about the experience, which is the cruise, which is doing something for yourself. So it's sort of a, I don't know if you're familiar with the pyramid of Maslow, but it's now that you have your basic survival needs as a consumer, which is your flat screen TV, your home, your car, now you go one step above that, which is, okay, now let's go for that experience, and I want to zip line in Costa Rica.
Barry, do we have any sense of how much of the shopping that we've been talking about is for gifts and how much is for the consumer, him or herself?
Well, we do know, or at least the CTA, the Consumer Technology Association, which until recently was the CEA, the Consumer Electronics Association, and that's the big trade association that produces the big CES trade show in Las Vegas every January, they've been reporting not only that it should be a very good year when online and in-store is taken together, but I also saw statistics from one of their reports that said 85% of the consumers who are shopping for electronics for gifts will also buy something for themselves, yeah.
That makes sense to me. Hey, I really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Gina.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Philippe Duverger is a professor of marketing at Towson University. His articles about marketing have been published in the International Journal of Market Research and the Journal for Advancement in Education. Barry Myers is founder and president of Get Geeked Media, a company based in New York City that aims to help consumer tech brands address difficult marketing challenges. Hope you get some holiday weekend, both of you. Hope you're not all busy with market research on this holiday weekend.
I'll be selling the Potomac.
I'm getting ready to go out on the hunt.
Terrific. Thank you both. Coming up next, following the death of his father, a young man in East Baltimore worked with local artists to paint a mural. He tells us how art has helped him heal. That's when Midday continues. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us on 88.1. Welcome back to Midday on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Picture this. A blue and gold scarab. Green vines. Masks opening to reveal the face of an African-American man. I'm describing a mural that can be seen at Orleans Street and Patterson Park Avenue in McKeldry Park. If you can't go see it in person, take a look at the photos on the Midday page at wipr.org/midday. The mural is titled Renaissance or Rebirth. It was dedicated earlier this month, but this is just the first phase of the project. Efforts are underway to raise funds for a garden to go with the mural. Joining me in studio are the artists who designed the mural, Edgar Reyes. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
And Pablo Maccioli. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And with us here in the studio is the son of the man depicted in the mural, Derek Smith Jr.
Hi.
His father, Derek Smith, was murdered in Elkton, Maryland in May of this year, 6 months ago. Derek Smith Jr., along with other young people in the community, helped to create the mural. Derek, I'm so sorry about your loss. Tell me a little bit about your father.
My dad was very friendly. He loved to help people. Because me and him, we used to talk all the time, and we used to talk about feeding the homeless and helping people and giving back to the community and things like that. And since his death, I am more able to do the things that we talked about, because he talked about starting up a small business, and right now I'm going to classes at school to learn how to write business plans, things like that.
What school do you go to?
I go to Baltimore Polytechnic Institute. Yeah, so it's on
and
Cold
you,
Spring.
You intend to start a business?
I intend to start a business.
Cool.
Yes.
I want to talk to you more about the mural, but first I want to learn more about the artist. Edgar, you went to Maryland Institute College of Art, correct?
Yeah, I did.
And you studied community arts. What does community arts involve?
I think the big thing, it's not just mural working. I think a lot of people, when they think community arts, it's mural work. I happen to be starting to be a muralist. But the big thing with community arts is engaging people. It could be young people, it can be adults, it could be anybody. But engaging them in a way of using art as a way of social justice, creating a change in their community, either be bringing about a bus line or just improving food services in the area or dealing with housing. For me, community arts, I use it as a way to engage inner city youth. Mainly young men. Most of them are African-American and Latino teens. So my big thing is just to show them that they can create a local immediate change using art.
So you've also served as an AmeriCorps volunteer for Baltimore United Viewfinders, which is a program from Micah House that teaches young people how to tell stories through multimedia arts. And then you developed a project called Open Hearts to connect Baltimore United Viewfinders with Casa de Maryland's youth program, Mi Espacio. So you're bringing African-American and Latino young people together. What kind of conversations did you hear about race and their neighborhoods?
I guess where I want to start is the reason why I do it. And it kind of relates back to this mural. I lost a loved one due to racial tensions in Los Angeles, and I was, Latino and African American, and moving into the city, I saw that was a big thing happening slowly but surely. At least I thought, and what really confirmed it was just talking to the kids and having conversations about not so much just race. I think it's really hard to as soon as you walk into the room, ask a kid, "Oh, let's talk about race." It was more like, "How was your day?" or things that are coming about. And I remember, I think it was two summers ago, there was some conflicts in Digital Harbor at the high school there. Mm-hmm. And there was just kids were getting in fights and they were racially driven. And I think that's where our conversation started, really, about the tensions between them. And it was just, I think the big thing is not that they despise each other, they hate each other. I think it's just misunderstanding of the cultural differences and also the similarities. And that's really the big conversations that I had with the kids, was who are we? Why are Latinos moving into the city? What does it mean to be an African American living in Baltimore? And then how could they work together? And that was the biggest scope of our conversations was that. It wasn't so much why are we so different? It was more, how can we work together to bring about mutual change? And the big thing was for the kids was to get the both communities to work together to improve the community. And that's the most of the conversations that came about. But it's
a big conversation.
Yeah. It's difficult just to show up, I think, and let's talk about race.
Sure.
I think you have to build those relationships first.
Pablo Macchioli, you've got murals all over Baltimore. Bromo Arts and Entertainment District in Sandtown over by the Horseshoe Casino. How did you get involved in this project with Edgar?
Well, we made a creative alliances. I was painting a mural inside, and he was working on installation for the Chicanism and Latinism art show. And we, during the installation, we start talking and knowing each other, and we connect really good because we have kind of the background of the Latinos is very similar, and of course the language, we start talking Spanish a lot that days, and that way we met and actually become some ideas to start doing something together actually that same day, right?
Yeah, that same day I was actually installing the mask, the inspiration for the piece there. And it was almost 2 years ago where kind of the seed for the mural started.
Yeah. We say, you know, this is a good opportunity to you know, to paint something for the city, which one connect, you know, other cultures to this new culture.
Derek, how did it strike you when you heard about this idea?
So at first, I honestly didn't know how to feel about it. But then, soon after, I'm like, let's do it. Because, it's hard to explain. But I wanted to, honor my, dad in a better way than just burn him in, the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Would do seem weird to me, because you love that person your whole life, and then you're just gonna pin them the ground. So that the mural was a way for me to deal with the grief in a better way, and to send off my dad in a better way than mm-hmm. just pin him in the ground.
So tell me something about the process of making this mural. I mean, what were the steps?
I first started when I first got the news from Derek. I remember on our drive, we were taking pictures for something we got hired out to do. And I was like, Derek, why didn't you tell me sooner? And it had been almost 2 weeks or so since his dad was murdered. Mm. And we started there. I slowly built up kind of the courage of telling him, let's do something in response. I really wanted to do a mural like me and Pablo had just said. We had the idea of the mask. But I slowly saw Derek had been really connecting with the earth. And he said it a little while ago when he was talking about him and his dad really connecting, having conversations about just improving just the well-being just of as a holistic person, just, mm-hmm. you know, planting or helping the homeless, mm-hmm. and maybe even starting a business. But planting, I saw, was a really big thing that Derek really got into. And I slowly bought him, you know, tomato plant, or here's some seeds, so, you know, so you can grow some purple corn, which is a native from Peru. And slowly but surely, we started building on our ideas. And I, you know, reached out to Pablo. I was like, you know, I'm considering maybe doing a mural with Derek around his dad. What do you think? And me and Pablo agreed and, you know, proposed it to Derek. And Derek asked his family, and they reflected on it, and they gave us, I guess, the right or kind of the okay to do it. We launched the GoFundMe site, and we got a little bit of money through that. And, you know, again, how the world works, during that time, we also got another mural that we got commissioned to do, and that mural actually planted the seed money for this project. And that's kind of where we started. It's very kind of organic, I guess, the way me and Pablo work. It's very natural. It seems like we've known each other forever. Mm. And I think that's the beauty of collaboration. I think when it works is when you barely say anything, but you do a lot. And that's the same way when we put paint on the wall. Naturally, kids just start showing up. Even kids that I've only met for the last, you know, 10 minutes, they grab a paintbrush and start helping us, you know, prime the wall or even just put a solid colors on the wall.
That's Edgar Reyes here on Midday on WYPR 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Edgar is one of the artists who designed the mural we're talking about in McKeldry Park, East Baltimore. Also with us is Pablo Macchioli, the other artist who designed the mural, and Derek Smith Jr., son of the man depicted in the mural. Derek collaborated on the project. Derek, what does it mean to have a place like this mural that you can go to remember your father?
Hmm. Well, like, to me, it means it's a place for me to, like come to, like meditate and to release my, like feelings and to deal with, like grief. Because, like, sometimes I wake up depressed and tired and I don't want to go to school. But then, like, I get up and I go outside. And, like, before I walk to school, I go look at the mirror for about 5 minutes. And then I'm like, okay, I'm good. I can do this. I can get through the day. So yeah. So for me, the mural is a place of like second chances. This place to like inspire me and to like motivate me throughout the day and things like that. So, yeah.
Before I let you go, someone tell me a bit about the meaning of the different components of the mural of Derek's dad, the scarab. I mean,
Yeah.
What are these elements supposed to tell?
Well, I think the big thing, the first thing you see when you drive on Pulaski Highway is you see the face, and you see these other layers of faces growing from Derek's father's face, and it's kind of you currently living in the earth. I mean, as you get older, that's the second mask, and then the third mask is death, but really the idea of whether are you dead or are you still here spiritually. And it's a Mayan mask of rebirth, and it's ongoing cycle that they believe. But for me, and I think for the majority of us, is the fact that, like when we celebrate Dia de los Muertos, it's celebrating the fact that you're able to rejoice and enjoy those moments with that person, and just recognizing at least even in that moment when you're looking at the mural, like the impact that person had in Derek's life and the positive things that he wanted to bring about in the community. As we move on through the mural, I mean, even the colors are very vibrant. So for me, it was just bringing back my culture into that neighborhood as it's slowly changing to be very diverse. It's predominantly African American, but slowly but surely becoming mixed and becoming even more so Latino. So bringing that pop of color just brightens up that neighborhood, but also brings back, you know, those rich colors that we see in Latin America, not just in Mexico. And then the fact that it's a Mayan mask, I mean, it reconnects it back to the native roots that not just Baltimore has, but the Americas has. And then the scarab, I think that's the most beautiful thing, I believe, because it's Egyptian. And Derek currently and a lot of the other boys that I mentor, they're kind of going through this phase right now where they're reconnecting back to the motherland, back to Africa. They're being very Afrocentric. And, you know, realizing that there was kings, there was pharaohs, there was people that looked like them that were, you know, in control of this land. And, you know, slavery, you know, came about and a lot of the history got erased, and it's reconnecting back to that. And that meaning of that scarab is when you're faced with trials and tribulations in life, there's two ways you can go. You can just be stuck in that kind of depressed moment and just be like, oh, my life's so crappy and I can't really, you know, get past this moment, or you can move past it and learn from that experience. So for me, just putting that symbol there mixed with everything else, you know, tied it back to the fact that it is an African-American community, but then there's also shared experiences with the Latinos.
I would like to add just to put like this type of image on the street, able to everybody take a look, an image with a lot of meaning and a lot of content and a lot of color, give also us the possibility to create in the people, to spark the creativity and start asking questions, try to make the difference with what we see often in the visual landscape, where we are full of superficial and violent images on billboards and, you know, all around the city. And this is, to do the murals and to help community to think about and ask questions about the image, I think it's really important.
Yeah. I really appreciate you telling us about it. Thank you very, very much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Edgar Reyes and Pablo Macchioli are artists whose murals can be seen around the city. Derek Smith Jr. is a senior at the Baltimore Polytechnic Institute. He helped create a mural to remember his father. That mural is located in McKeldry Park, and pictures can be seen at the Midday Show page. That's WIPR.org/midday. The GoFundMe account set up to fund the garden in memory of Derek's dad can be found at GoFundMe.com/Derek Garden. DerickGarden. We have a link to that at our website, too. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, urban farms in Baltimore don't close up shop when the winter months hit. Stay tuned for that. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast, and now on this day after the Thanksgiving feast, we're going to talk about growing food. The official start of winter, December 22nd, is less than a month away. Already temperatures early this week flirted with freezing, but for the thriving community of urban farmers in Baltimore, those falling temperatures do not mean their production stops. We're about to learn about two very different indoor farming techniques and educational programs that keep urban farmers busy during these frigid months. Joining me in the studio is Isabel Antresian, program manager at the Whitelock Community Farm in Reservoir Hill. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Laura Janello, farm manager of the Food System Lab at Silburn on the grounds of Silburn Arboretum. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Isabel Antresian, let's start with you, since your farm does most of its work outdoors. What kinds of vegetables are you able to grow indoors during the winter months?
We grow a lot of hardier winter vegetables, which is a bunch of greens and also root vegetables. So we're doing spinach, arugula, kale, baby chard, a couple different types of other salad mixes, and also turnips, radishes, and beets.
And what kind of setting are you growing these in?
These are in a hoop house. So we have two hoop houses at Whitelock. I think about 11 beds total that we're growing in.
And what do you do with them, these vegetables that you grow?
So we are part of the Farm Alliance in Baltimore, and together with several other urban farms, we sell together at a farmer's market in the city in Waverly. So we share a table there. So we send a lot of our produce there. We also will do some restaurant sales. And we're experimenting a little bit with continuing our mobile market through the winter. So we may be selling some of those at the elementary school in the neighborhood and maybe a couple of other sites that we haven't identified yet.
Your mobile market, this is like a bicycle-led wagon, right, on which you carry vegetables to sell?
Yes, it's a bicycle and a trailer that we fill with vegetables each week and send it to a couple different sites in the neighborhood. So during the warmer months, we go to the elementary school in the morning and sell to teachers and also kids' parents. We have a farm club at the elementary school, so the students that are involved in that actually help with the selling of the produce to their families and their teachers. We've also started this year stopping outside of a couple corner stores in the neighborhood.
But you haven't done this yet in cold weather.
Not in cold weather. Usually, so our selling season is May through November. And then we have a new employee this year who's expressed some interest in thinking through new delivery services in the neighborhood. And so she's interested in kind of expanding our mobile market to continue through the winter.
So what is different about growing crops indoors? I mean, what you have to choose the crops, of course, but I mean, do they grow at a different pace? Do they taste different?
They definitely grow at a different pace. Of course, during the summer, there's more hours of light and it's warmer, right? So you have different plants react differently to those things. Some of those winter crops can handle the cold a little bit better, and so they can continue to grow even though it's maybe, I don't know, 40, 50 degrees in the high tunnel. Taste-wise, I'm not sure. Probably.
I should ask your customers.
Yeah.
Laura Janelle, let me ask you, you're involved in aquaponics.
Yes. Yeah.
What is aquaponics?
Yeah, so aquaponics is a system of agriculture that actually combines two different systems. The first is aquaculture, so the practice of raising fish. And we take aquaculture and we combine it with hydroponics, which is the practice of growing plants in water. So what that means is we're raising both fish and plants in the same setup, and we grow all our plants in water from the fish tanks. So the fish basically provide all the nutrients for the plants to grow, and then the plants filter the water for the fish.
So it's a virtuous circle.
Yeah, so exactly.
And other than the seeds for the plants and the baby fish for the fish, mm-hmm. does it need any inputs?
It does, yeah. So it's a closed loop in terms of the water. It's a very water-efficient method of growing. But we definitely need inputs. So we're adding fish feed for the fish, which is one of our inputs. And another major input for us is energy. And that particularly comes into play this time of year when it's cold out, because we're heating the water for the fish. We're raising tilapia, which are a tropical fish. So they actually like their water temperature quite warm, around 70 degrees.
And you're doing this outside?
We actually do everything inside a hoop house as well. So we have the option of heating our hoop house, so we'll keep it above freezing in there. But we do it all indoors year-round.
So you heat the air in the hoop house, but also the water?
Yes, so we heat both.
And what kind of crops do you grow?
Yeah, so we raise tilapia as a food crop, so they're one of our crops. And then in terms of vegetables, we're growing a lot of the cold, hardy greens that Isabel mentioned, so things like chard, lettuces, kale, bok choy. And it happens that those crops naturally do really well in the winter because they're very cold hardy, but they tend to naturally adapt really well to aquaponics as well, because in aquaponic systems, you end up with a lot of nitrogen from the fish waste, and that nitrogen is going to promote a lot of leaf growth in plants, so leafy greens work well.
And let me ask you the taste question.
Yeah.
How do these plants grown in this closed loop system and grown in water mm-hmm. compare to what soil grown crops would taste like?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So I grow a soil garden at my house, and I eat plants from both systems, and I think they taste really comparable. I find the stuff that comes out of our system tastes very similar to what I grow in soil. But an interesting point on winter growing is a lot of plants will actually get sweeter in the cold weather. So we don't grow any roots, but crops like parsnips will actually get sweeter the colder it is, because some of the starches turn to sugars as the cold weather sets in.
If they were grown outdoors, but in your heated system, do they still have would they have that reaction?
Right. Well, it is still cool in our greenhouse, so it'll get down to freezing temperatures, so it's not as warm as it would be in the summer. But yeah, so they wouldn't to the same degree.
Is there some way of describing how much energy is involved, how much added energy is involved?
Yeah, absolutely. So it can be a lot. So for us, the majority of our energy costs take place in the winter. And between electricity and propane, we spend a couple $1,000s each year heating our system. And we have a 1,200 square foot greenhouse.
And with the way the market is for food right now in the U.S., does what you grow pay for that kind of energy cost?
So our system was not set up with the goal of being profitable. We're more focused on educational programming.
Right.
So our system doesn't make a profit. We are able to cover our energy cost, and we do a pretty good job covering some of our other operating expenses. But when you add labor into the mix, that's what really tips the scale. There are people who practice aquaponics around the country commercially. And we've found that I think people in warmer climates tend to have a better chance of being profitable than those in colder climates because of those energy costs.
That's Laura Ginello, a farm manager at the Food System Lab at Silburn, here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Illabel Antrician, the program manager at the Whitelock Community Farm on Reservoir Hill. And we're talking about ways to keep growing food during cold weather. Isabel, you host cooking classes also, right?
Yes.
Are most of the ingredients things that you've grown on the farm?
It's kind of split. Usually we try to incorporate something that we've grown on the farm. We've also been fortunate enough to get a donation of ingredients from Whole Foods this year. So they are providing kind of the bulk of the ingredients that go into the meal, but we will bring in things that we've grown on the farm, both that kids who are in the cooking class may have helped to grow through the farm club, but also just to kind of introduce them to, like, what is the seasonal vegetable and be able to show them, like, oh, this part of the meal that we're cooking with right now is something that's actually growing up the street right now.
Are there other educational classes besides cooking that you do?
We have the farm club that meets once a week, and that's designed to, it starts in the early spring with students inside the classroom, and it's designed to introduce them both to plant growth, local food systems compared to national food systems. What is the kind of food environment within their neighborhood of Reservoir Hill? And we talk a little bit about food access within the neighborhood and what are barrier points to people accessing fresh, healthy food. And then when it starts to get warmer, the kids actually come up to the farm once a week and are there introduced to kind of farm infrastructure, what tools we use, like techniques of farming, as well as concepts of, like, what is the ecosystem at the farm? What is decomposition and what does composting do? And then also like introducing them to the farm as a community space and kind of talk about different community programming we do and different workshops we host and kind of invite them to think about like what sort of workshop or community education would be beneficial in our neighborhood. So it's kind of mixed both food and community building. So that's the Farm Club. And then a lot of those students are also involved in the cooking class. It's an after-school program at the rec center. So at that program, we're just cooking. We're learning both cooking skills and kind of familiarity with different utensils we use in the kitchen. Also talk about what is a balanced meal, and then also try and teach them how to make meals that they're already familiar with and they already like. So we'll ask them kind of like, what are some of your favorite foods? And then try to like take a step back and talk about what goes into making those and actually make them together.
And Laura, since you're part of Johns Hopkins, I presume education is part of what you all do too.
Yeah, that's actually a big part of our goals with the project. We love having school groups come out for school group tours. We work with all ages from middle school up through college age and adult. And the really great thing about aquaponics is it's a great way to basically use get people inspired about thinking about agriculture and use the system as a teaching tool for sustainable agriculture principles more generally, but also some STEM concepts as well. So we've had a lot of science teachers get really excited about coming out to our farm to show kids the nitrogen cycle and give people a real world example of some of the concepts they're talking about in the classroom.
By the way, how do vegans feel about the aquaponics, this circle that includes raising an animal for food?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I think the answer to that probably depends on who you talk to and what people's personal opinions are, because we are raising fish. We are raising them as a food crop. There are certainly ways to raise non-food fish in aquaponics. You can choose not to eat them, but it is a system of animal farming. So I think that, you know, if you object to animal farming on a general basis, then aquaponics, you know, is another way of animal farming. But
and so some people might object and some don't.
Yeah. I imagine that's probably the case.
Well, I really get the impression from both of you that life doesn't slow down during the cold weather. Are you as,
yeah.
I mean, is there an aspect of regrouping and kicking back, or are you as busy? And are your growing mechanisms as busy in the cold weather as in spring and summer?
Yeah, so we're pretty busy. The plants definitely slow down, so they grow much slower. So that does lead to just some of the production cycle work being a little bit less. But the winter's also a great time to do your crop plan for the spring and maybe get to some projects that you didn't get to in the summer. We fix a lot of things in the winter, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's definitely nice to have the couple months of slower production to work on both the planning and fixing things that maybe weren't working so well during the season. We also we continue on with a lot of our programming, but it's at a slower rate.
So. Well, I appreciate you both talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Have a good time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Laura Dinello is farm manager at the Food System Lab at Silburn, on the grounds of Silburn Arboretum. Isabel Antresian is the program manager at the White Lock Community Farm in Reservoir Hill. We have links to their project at our website, wypr.org/midday. I'm very glad you've been listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now and then Science Friday at 2. I hope you're having a great holiday weekend, and we will be back on Monday. I look forward to speaking with you then.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Connor Graham. Midday's intern is Adam Droneberg. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at wypr.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.